Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, or good morning or afternoon if you're listening to the podcast rather than the live stream. This is John Johnson on Radio Edutalk. Today, or this evening, we're going to be talking to Deirdre Robson and Ivor Hickey of the Leonardo Effect. They're going to be talking about putting art into STEM and motivating pupils to achieve through interdisciplinary arts and sciences. We'll get into that a wee bit more. If you want to join in at all, you can send a tweet with the hashtag Edutalk, E-D-U-T-A-L-K, or at any time you can send an email to edutalker, that's E-D-U-T-A-L-K-R, at hotmail.co.uk. So if you've got a question for Deirdre or Ivor, you can either tweet it or send us a mail and ask your question. Later on or after it, you can leave comments, because the audio will be archived on Edutalk as usual. Missing tonight is the slightly more professional tone of David Noble, who's caught up in various real life adventures, but we'll just struggle on without him. I'm going to ask Deirdre and Ivor just to introduce themselves, maybe give it a wee bit of background about where they've come from professionally, how they've got into this sort of education, and how they got involved with the Leonardo Effect, and then we'll go into actually talking about what it is and things like that. So either Ivor or Deirdre, do you want to start and give us a wee bit of background?
Hello, John, good evening, and thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to speak on the programme this evening.
Delighted.
My background actually is art. I came through art college and did a teacher education diploma following that, and taught for 10 years in the post-primary sector before going into teacher training, where I've been for quite a number of years now. And throughout that process, I think it came to me that there was more and more commonality between art and science than I ever could have realised. And this is perhaps where Ivor should come in, actually, because it was through conversations together about art and science that the Leonardo Effect actually came into existence.
Yeah, I come from a different background in that I am a career scientist. I spent over 20 years doing research mainly in cell biology and genetics. And the link that came to education when I worked in the Faculty of Science was that I was responsible for the education students that took modules with us, and it was very, very interesting to see that they were slightly different to the science students. They had a broader aspect, and basically it became clear to me that science is not seen as a creative subject, but of course it is definitely a creative subject. Those people who have succeeded, the classic of course being Einstein, are highly aware of its creativity, and therefore the connection with art came through an initial desire to see if we could put together something that would make clear to learners that art was a subject, but at the same time science, which is recognized as a serious subject, was also a highly creative subject. So that gives you a little bit of idea of our backgrounds and where the project originated from.
So we had a conversation which was somewhat more lengthy than perhaps it should have been. We debated the topic for about 2 years over coffee breaks, and we got to the point where we thought, you know, we should really try and test this, our hypothesis, in schools. So we applied for a little bit of funding through a body called Escalate to try it in primary schools to see if art and science really could work together in a really compatible and productive way to excite children about learning. And the response we got from Escalate was really, really interesting. They said that they thought there was much more mileage in our idea than we realised. And they recommended that we should pursue more funding to make it a bigger project than we initially had in mind. So where we were hoping to work in a couple of schools, or perhaps one school, we sort of increased our ambition a little bit more. And we applied then to the Paul Hamlin Foundation, who responded really positively to it and actually gave us twice as much money as we asked them for. So that set us on a path where we couldn't possibly have anticipated where it might take us. So we went into schools in Northern Ireland at this stage, and the outcomes were really very, very interesting, not least of all because art and science was very compatible, and creativity came out of the children, and increased engagement came out of the children. But also children's literacy was coming through, and this wasn't something we had expected or even sought. So after that successful project, we thought perhaps we should take this beyond the island of Ireland and test a wider context in different regions of the UK where different curricula was in place. So we applied to Nesta, and Nesta came back and said, we think there's more mileage in this idea than you realise. So again, and they said, you've obviously gone to work in primary schools. We would like you to look at the interface between primary and secondary as well. So simultaneously, we ran a little pilot in secondary while we ran a big pilot in primary across all the UK. Not with a huge number of schools.
We had about 2 dozen schools. There were,
But out of that, the Leonardo effect was born. It wasn't something we set out to do, devise an interdisciplinary teaching approach. We had a very, very small idea at the beginning, which grew largely because of the feedback that we got from teachers. Said, you know, this is actually working, and perhaps Ivor would like to say more on that.
Yeah, I think what it really surprised us, we were focused on creativity and art science, and it really surprised us, and we got this continuously from teachers, how the effects spread right throughout their teaching experience, their planning experience, the whole life of the school. And I think it comes down to the fact that if you want children to be interested in their schooling, their education, you have to provide them with a very interesting environment. And we haven't talked very much about how the Leonardo works on the ground.
Yeah.
But just putting those two subjects that children enjoy, they all enjoy science because it's hands-on, they all enjoy art because it's hands-on, but some are reticent about science because they think, oh, I can get this wrong. And by putting the two together and by allowing their actions a bit of freedom, it does actually work very, very well.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite fascinating because I think a lot of people see a sort of dichotomy between arts and sciences. I know myself, way back in the day when I went to university, I studied science, and my wife was at art school studying painting. And there's like a tension between the two, or people see a tension between the two. And I think it's really interesting that you both come together and picked in this creativity idea as well. I think that'd be quite a surprise for some people.
It was a surprise. We polled students about this, and they put only religion further from science than art.
Yeah.
Even languages were closer to science than art, because when you come through the school system and you have everything compartmentalized through to A-levels or highers in the Scottish case, children seem to be divided into the art stream or the science stream very, very heavily, and often very early on.
So it's quite tricky to...
It's a bit revolutionary for them to see that they can put it back together again, but once they've started doing it, and in a way, if you can put art and science together, and Deirdre will probably say more in a minute about, because she's very interested in the commonalities between the subjects, not just running them in parallel, but working through the intricate similarities of the two processes. If you can put those two together, you can put almost any part of the curriculum together if you want to develop an interactive curriculum running right across everything in the school. You've got the wherewithal to do that.
I say just all the time, you think people who are of a scientific bent will sometimes be scared of art, and people who are artistic may be scared. I mean, a lot of certainly primary school teachers, I think, would fall into one camp or the other. They would be happier doing a science lesson or happier doing an art lesson rather than trying to do both, you know?
Well, Well, in a way, this is leads into the actual structure of the Leonardo, because we give the children who are undergoing the lessons a lot of freedom in the planning, or a lot of opportunity to take part in the planning of the lessons. So it's the children's ideas that count a lot, just what the teacher has in his or her kit bag that day. So the planning comes in, because artists and scientists both plan their activities. They don't just happen. Although I know in school it tends to be, we're going to do solubility today, or we're going to paint a house.
Yes.
Well, that's probably a bit unfair on the art teacher.
I think maybe one of the problems with that for a teacher is the planning. And I know now that many teachers take children's interests on board at the start, and they plan a lesson by discussing what the children know and what they want to learn. But one of the sort of imagined difficulties about this, I think, is that you think, how am I going to resource it? You know, if they want to, if we get all these diverse ideas for what children want to do, how do we resource it? Do I know enough? Am I confident enough to be able to follow the children?
Things you can do here is, this is a classic opportunity for the teacher to learn along with the children, to develop the idea of a learning community. We have some schools who have developed Leonardo to a large extent, where if it's a drawing exercise, the teacher draws and the children draw, and sometimes they draw what the teacher does. Children can do research, find out facts, and design experiments with the full interaction of the teacher. Maybe you'd like to say something, Deirdre, about the actual structure.
I think we need to get, I need certainly to get an idea of how it would work if you were coming in, say, to do a project. If I was still a primary school teacher, you're going to do a project, how long would it take, how would it start, all the rest of it, that sort of stuff.
Okay. Well, the Leonardo effect in itself is just, it's a model or a structure. It's not a program that we give teachers to follow. And we're not very precious about boundaries between subjects and things. And that's because, just to go back just ever so slightly, to say that what art and science has in common is things like the topic the children might be exploring, or the fact that you experiment in art and in science, or you observe and record in art and science. Those sort of very fundamental commonalities, when you look at them in broad daylight, you see that to say one is science or one is art is actually counterproductive. So the little model that we use in the classroom that seems to work very well is that children spend time gathering information, doing research on a particular topic, such as the woodland or flight, for example, or weather.
And you can see that these are very broad topics.
Yeah.
Which gradually become more focused down when you listen to the children's ideas, and they make suggestions and they ask questions. One fundamental aspect of it is that the children should have first-hand experience in that very, very first stage. And through giving children first-hand experience, such as a visit to the woodland, what happens is the children come up with questions themselves, or spontaneous questions. And they're usually at a much higher level than questions that may come from a very classroom-based activity or through the teacher imparting information to the children.
Mm-hmm.
So those self-generated questions and that first-hand experience seems to capture the curiosity and the interest of the children, and that's motivating in itself. And that's really a very important or crucial starting point to the Leonardo effect. And it's not essentially our idea, it's Leonardo da Vinci's. He said that he needed first-hand experience to inspire him in developing his ideas, and it's something scientists do and artists do naturally in their own work all of the time. So what we've done is take that down to the children's level, and it means that yes, you know what questions are going to come from the children, but we have found that teachers will say before they start, oh gosh, this might be a bit daunting.
Mm-hmm.
But once they actually go with it, they find it really exhilarating and interesting, and children tend to surpass expectations. So once children Catherine have spent time gathering information, doing research, and putting it together, in notebooks, writing large pages, and drawing, taking photographs, asking experts, all sorts of things. Ideally, you as a teacher should identify where there is a really good question coming from the children, or where there's potential to take this to the next level, where they can experiment and develop ideas. And that's probably the most creative aspect of the whole project. Some schools will never take it beyond the gathering information stage, and to be honest, that's absolutely fine. There's so much really great wealth of opportunity in there on its own.
So
you can evaluate at the end of it in terms of children's learning.
So you would, I mean, that this process would take quite a long time then. Say if we meant a visit to wherever, a woodland, they generate questions, children do research, but that would go on over a period of days or weeks, or
it comes back into the classroom and it's followed up there. And we've tried at different times to set a time limit on the thing, and what we've always found is if we set a time limit, a school comes back and says, we would like to double the length of time. Don't give them a time, they want a time. So I think it's something you adapt to your own situation in your own school.
If we talk about the national pilot we did in the primary schools, the original one,
mm-hmm.
That was structured around the theme of flight. We standardized it so that all schools would work on the same theme, so it would be easier to evaluate. And a lot of schools have gone on since and used a whole range of themes. But the children knew that at the end of the project, they would be creating, and they knew that the target was to create a flying creature. Now, this isn't a technology project, so it didn't have to fly.
Mm.
So it would be animal, machine, mythical, or any mixture of those three. So it could be anything. So they knew that there was a job at hand. And then that wide gathering of information process began. And usually they would have a visit. Very often they went to YFPB Centre, or some would go to a flight museum or aircraft manufacturers. It is as wide as that, and we're, as Deirdre said, we're very unprecious about the action of flight.
Yeah.
And you're thinking about resourcing, and what we found was that on almost any topic, there are organisations out there who are very keen to come into schools, usually with their education officers, who are given any opportunity, they will support the school. It's a win-win situation. It's good for them, it's good for the school. And we also find in many cases parents, grandparents will generate information and help, because the children are going home and talking at home about what they would call the flight project. Never the art of the flight project or the science of the flight project, but the two together. And then that allows for this period that Deirdre was talking about. This develops into focusing down within the class on certain aspects, and then that development of ideas, which is often so difficult in the classroom because as you have something, you have to get to the end of it to get on to the next thing. Development of ideas, the trying out of things, the having ideas, evaluating ideas, going back to the drawing board, that is so terribly good for involving children and so very good for getting them to use their brains in what's usually referred to as the lifelong learning skills.
Mm-hmm.
To use the phrase confident contributors when they leave school. So it's not that expensive to do. There is a little bit of cost involved, but then there's a cost involved in all genuine school activities.
And would you see this, I mean, if we were doing a Leonardo project, would this take over all day, or would it be, would you still run your normal maths, language, other bits and pieces along with it, or would it become subsumed into the project?
Well, again, it depends on the school and how to work. I can think of particular examples in school, in schools where one school, for example, uses it from primary 1 right the way through to primary 7 after Christmas every year in a chosen theme. Every class is involved in that theme. But in the first term, they deal with the things that they feel don't fit into the Leonardo effect, that mm-hmm. they don't fit and don't work for them. And while they are doing the Leonardo effect and after Christmas, they find that, you know, literacy comes in, numeracy comes in, geography, history, all the other subjects, you know, that they need to cover with it come in very naturally to it.
Yeah.
Whereas in another school, you might find they only do it at Key Stage 2. Some other schools maybe only do it 2 days a week or 2 afternoons a week.
Mm-hmm.
So we feel that it's the school and the teachers. So we don't put any kind of sort of limit or, you know, we don't specify precisely the number of hours or anything, because people adapt it to suit their situations. But I would like to say is what Ivor was talking about there in that development of ideas stage, which is where the creativity really happens. It teases out the whole learning process. It's almost like an elongation of time mm-hmm. in a very, very nice way, where all of those things like thinking skills and children working together and all these really important aspects of the revised curricula across the UK, you know, people are trying to find ways to put them in. And they just happen so naturally and so easily. And we get lovely examples coming back to us from schools where, say, for example, in Wales, where children spend sometimes 2 years with the same teacher, the children come back the next year, and when they're doing something like a graph of some kind, the teacher will say, "He didn't actually have to stand and tell them how to do this."
Yeah.
They started to work it out for themselves. And to me, that really shows that, you know, teasing out the learning and giving children time to really think and work things out for themselves, it's time extremely well spent.
Yeah.
After the development of ideas stage, there's another stage which is called creation or applying knowledge. And that's where it takes the learning to the higher level, because they don't just have these facts and ideas, they get to apply them. And it can be wonderful to see children, you know, for whom they've thought maybe children, you know, couldn't, you know, reach that kind of level, do it. Even primary one children can achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
Nice example of that was the school that researched bridges so they could design wings.
Mm-hmm.
They were just researching cantilever bridges and suspension bridges. They had to produce a wing for this creature. When I talked about the creatures earlier on, I said they were imaginary, but they had to be justifiable. You know, if you're flying creature only had one wing, that was because you wanted it to fly in circles. That's a sort of ridiculous example.
Yeah, yeah.
It needed the beauty of acquiring imagination, but that imagination had to be checked up against reality. And to get into the sort of theory, that's what really good science is. A really good scientist actually has to imagine how the process might work in the cell or in place. And with the possibilities, and then look at ways in which they can be investigated. And that's very different from school science, of course, where people tend to know, the teacher usually knows the answer to the experiment,
mm-hmm.
children do it. And as someone who's worked a lot with school leaders, graduates, they tend to be rather skeptical about practical science, because the only exciting that ever happens is when it goes wrong.
Yeah. I can remember myself as an undergraduate, you usually knew what was expected from an experiment.
Yes.
And the idea was to get those results. It wasn't to see what happened, it was to
get all the points in straight in the row. And this is quite, quite different from this. And I think it allows children to actually act as junior scientists, because they're investigating something, not just by... This is part of it, but by getting information from the web and getting information from books and all sorts of other sources, but they can actually investigate in an experimental way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we know the project, teachers tell us over and over again, is tremendous for producing, stimulating literacy and communication skills. I'm still pushing schools a little bit to say science is not just a collection of facts, but in the investigation, if you record accurately, most scientific investigations will give you number, and that allows you to spill through into that cross-curricular development of new numeracy, dealing with numbers that are about things that the children have generated themselves, so they have an ownership of it.
So, I mean, one of the things it sounds like is I sort of left permanent classroom teaching about 3 or 4 years ago, just as Scotland was leaving the 5-14 curriculum and moving to the curriculum for excellence. And one of the things I always found quite frustrating was if you started something interesting or you were excited about, that there was a time constraint. You know, and if children did get excited about things and you took a topic away off on a particular thing, you wouldn't cover something that you were meant to tick. Because you did something else, and it sounds like this, what you're doing would fit very well with the curriculum for excellence in Scotland now.
We found the curriculum for excellence very, very exciting and very applicable. And the Leonardo is a very useful approach to bringing that interdisciplinary creative teaching together. But what we would always say to teachers is that you do this interesting stuff, then you map it back to the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
You discover that you cover more than you want, but there will be other areas which you don't teach through Leonardo method.
Yeah,
we have the mapping back is a very good characteristic of disciplinary teaching. And two teachers in Scotland, as a side shoot to the original project, mapped the whole thing back to the curriculum for excellence.
Yeah,
I'm sure that it fitted very, very well. And of course, the advantage in primary is that the teacher is total control. They can change the timetable a little bit.
Well, that when you talk to secondary colleagues, you realise that very often they're split up into 40-minute chunks, although we're beginning, I think, to see the curriculum for excellence getting into secondary schools, and I've certainly seen some very interesting cross-curricular projects which are taken right through, you know, from science through music to drama to literacy. And connecting all those up around one topic in a similar way. So I'm guessing you work with secondary schools as well?
We've just finished a pilot in post-primary, trying to integrate art and science together. It's sort of a slight development of the Leonardo effect. Mm-hmm. And what we find is primary schools are in such a lucky position that your time is more flexible.
Yeah.
As the timetable in post-primary is making interdisciplinary learning so difficult for teachers. We're finding teachers very frustrated about it because, you know, students are coming up with really interesting ideas, and then the bell goes and they're saying, well, we'll have to return to this next Tuesday, and you just know that there isn't a real opportunity to actually return to it at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for interdisciplinary education to work in post-primary, there's structuring of the day within post-primary really needs to be looked at.
That
was one of the outcomes from the pilot that we had.
Well, I think I think the problem is in secondaries at the moment is once you hit working towards exams, then that becomes the main driver for teachers and pupils, because that's how they are, how the school is judged almost. So I think there's been opportunities for cross-curricular and breaking away from the timetable a wee bit in the lower secondary.
And some schools are making very determined efforts to actually do this.
Yeah.
I think that within the post-primary sector, you know, if we're finding integrating art and science is so motivating for children in primary, and we found it in secondary as well, but with certain restrictions due to timetable and so forth, but we feel that there is scope here to explore the topic of interdisciplinary GCSEs at some stage, because the world is moving on and the education system seems to be stuck in some way, in some form, because interdisciplinary learning simply brings subjects together and creates more creative outcomes and ideas and things. And you know, other combinations of subjects are in industry and in science and so forth, and there's much more of this happening, and I think we need to work back and see a little bit more of that in schools. I know we're finding that where the Leonardo is moving to be really established now in primaries, because mm-hmm. it's been running in some primaries for 6 years now, there's a demand in post-primary for it from those children coming through, and there's an interest in post-primary to actually accommodate them in many cases, but the system just isn't flexible enough at the moment to do it terribly well. So it's a really exciting time. There's tremendous potential there.
We found very interesting things by looking at a number of different schools. The project tends to run in the early part of secondary school.
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
Some schools will have a first year, which they collapse down and they have four teachers or five teachers instead of the complete range. And that allows the children a sort of intermediate phase between the primary and the classical secondary experience. And they were able to fit Leonardo in very, very effectively because they were already moving towards that. And we've been working with schools in a number of areas at a plan. But even where you have the strict subject demarcation, we found that the Leonardo worked best, and I think there are all sorts of sensible and down-to-earth reasons for this. It worked best where, one science teacher would work with one art teacher. They would be able to work reasonably well and sometimes very well together. But if you got to a situation where the art department had to have a meeting with the science department, they had to have minutes, and then
yeah,
have decisions, and then they discovered that they couldn't make the minute. They couldn't make the meetings, and you can see in the secondary school how it breaks down into complex organizational structure that secondary schools have to have.
Yeah.
So, as I say, we found some systems that work very well. It might be that this is a way of looking at how you can innovate in the secondary school, because we're all aware, and we now in the south of the border you have Mr. Gove, all sorts of changes. That secondary is very complex and is very difficult, and even assessing which children are benefiting most is tricky, because to some extent the examination system will really favour the people who just learn the facts and regurgitate them in the exam.
Yeah, we're not necessarily
looking for that.
Yeah. I'm kind of, just to kind of veer slightly off that, but talking about, you know, particular learners. One thing, and we'll mention this in slightly more detail later on, is I was looking at the blurb for your book on Amazon on the Leonardo effect, and one of the things you've said, you've done case studies on both disaffected learners and learners with special needs, and I wonder if you could maybe talk a wee bit more about the disaffected learners.
It wasn't something that we really targeted through the Leonardo effect. Ivor and I both came from the perspective initially of art and science, and trying to improve the profile of art and bring more creativity into science. But what head teachers and teachers came back to us with was that children were having severe difficulties in relating to other children and applying themselves, maybe even attending. All of those problems began to just diminish drastically.
Uh-huh.
And it was really quite a shock to us that this was the case. And yet when you think about it, you know, education should be about exciting and igniting an interest in learning. And if you do that, every child has potential and has the opportunity to come through or to come out. And that's exactly what we found. So we haven't heard any instances of children who were disaffected not responding to it.
Yeah.
And there have been some quite moving examples given to us. Sadly, in some cases when children have left primary, when they've been using it and gone on to secondary, they've returned to being disaffected again.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's really quite sort of disheartening for the children concerned. Working with special needs, on the other hand, similar situations apply. Some of the most creative examples of the Leonardo effect being delivered have actually been with children with difficulties with their sight or with their hearing, where those teachers naturally have to be very creative anyway to reach the children and to communicate knowledge to them and be creative in the activities they organise and so forth. And Fiver might want to say a little bit more about that.
There is a nice chapter book on that, and I think sort of extrapolate that.
So in the
special schools, the teachers do have to be more creative, but in standard education, creativity is not something that's looked for that often or or as often as it should be from teachers. And we found that teachers have had a lot of enjoyment out of the Leonardo approach because it allows the class to develop ideas, it allows them to develop ideas, it takes the strain away. They're no longer the person at the front who's the font of all knowledge, but then they're working, say, along with other people. And if you take this a bit further, we're all aware of the STEM initiative of science, engineering, technology, mathematics. And being a scientist, I'm very supportive of this. But it worries me intensely that this will be a push to groom children into enjoying science. Some children naturally do, but the mathematical, if you take the maths out of science, you seriously change the science. The mathematical aspects often terrify many children.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably seen the STEM to STEAM sort of thing. If you can bring art in there, and of course technology, art, design run very closely together, if you can bring art in there, you bring in multiple entry points. You allow children to identify with various things, and speaking, and I can do this speaking with just my science hat on as opposed to an educator hat, the art is really good for the children's science.
Right.
Because you always get the children who would have been like me, who are just obsessed with science. But the great swathe of children are not obsessed with science. And when you bring it with the art, and I suppose you could flip the argument about art as well,
mm-hmm.
put the two together, it really makes people much more interested in the science. And that's, if they're not interested in it, you're not going to get extra STEM graduates out at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think there's a whole argument to be gone over about where children's final destinations, or at least their destinations after school, should be. But obviously, we need at the moment engineers and scientists to some extent. And the times we're living in, and it sounds like that your approach would maybe be a wee bit more likely to draw people in than just focusing strictly on the science.
It's crucial to draw children into education, and it's just extremely sad that so many children leave school without a passion for anything or realizing that they're good at anything, and then. I always say to the students that I teach, there will be a substantial number of children in every primary class you ever teach for whom, you know, the arts is their area of expertise, and that's where their potential lies. And you can't afford to deny them the opportunities just because the curriculum is placing more emphasis on other areas.
Mm.
But the arts do provide multiple access points for children to access learning, and we believe that without art in the Leonardo effect, all of the outcomes that we're seeing, we wouldn't have them. And the STEM to STEAM movement is definitely, certainly on the increase, much more so in America, but it will make its way over here. We have no doubt about that. And the teachers that we're working with in schools, in clusters of schools that are now applying it in different parts of Scotland, and Wales, I think they're carrying it forward and spreading the word of that. And it does match many of the subjects in the curriculum, or most of them, which means it's true interdisciplinary learning. And the mechanism that we use for bringing subjects together is joint learning intentions or joint learning.
Your approach also seems to align itself quite well with, or to my mind, what I think of as cooperative learning in the classroom, or, you know, the idea of children taking on roles to do with a topic, because you will get people with a tendency towards maybe art, or maybe looking at something in a bit more rigor scientifically, and if they both can respond in their own different ways, they kind of fall naturally into roles in a team. Do you think that's got anything to do with what?
Yes. I think that's one of the things that really works. It works in groups. The other thing that teachers have often said to us is the thorny differentiating a lesson. And if you have it in this open Leonardo format, the children often differentiate themselves.
Yeah.
They set themselves different targets. and teachers have said to us that it supports the and I can't do this on the radio, but inverted commas, I'm waving my arms about, weaker children.
Yeah.
It supports them, but it places no ceiling on the more able, classically able children in the class, because they can take these development ideas as far as they want, and they get a lot of enjoyment and satisfaction out of it. And I think it comes back, if you get satisfaction out of your time in school, you enjoy your learning, you become adept at learning, and it's something that sticks with you. Whereas if you just memorize facts, and you're not good at memorizing facts, and your maths isn't good, you become disaffected, and that stays with you.
Yeah, and it sounds as well that the approach would engage teachers as well, once you let go of the control element and get into the learning together. It sounds like a very powerful effect for keeping teacher morale up, perhaps.
We've had some very amusing feedback from teachers saying that at the end of the first week they were terrified as to what would happen in the second week, but in the second week the children came up with so many ideas it became really enjoyable.
Yeah.
Although I think that first weekend might have been a bit frightening when they went home.
Yeah. Well, I think that to me that was always the sort of crutch we had in Scotland with the 5 to 14, that everything was very structured. And going into the curriculum for excellence, similarly to the Leonardo effect, was there's a bit of fear and uncertainty because you're going into the unknown a wee bit, and you're so used to taking control and responsibility that letting that go is quite difficult. But thinking about
there was a lovely example in one of the Scottish schools we worked with where the head teacher said, you know, I asked for the plans from my teacher in September, and the ones who were taking part in the Leonardo effect handed me theirs, and the normal situation I wouldn't have accepted these, it just wouldn't have been good enough, he said, but I had faith, I knew where they were going.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a question there, we should really, you know, can't we judge, you know, teachers' own professional judgment? And I know that could sound as if we're not being rigorous and how we evaluate the approach. But if we just, if a measure of the Leonardo effect had just been numerical, we would have very, very little data, really. We would have learned very little from all of the pilots that we ever did, because teachers came back with really specific gems of information regarding how children learn and how this works for them. And it's sort of sad that teachers don't get asked very often about what really works in the classroom and what doesn't. And I have to say, we saw some superb examples of teaching in Scotland where, you know, the teachers were genuinely listening to the ideas of the children and then, you know, strategically were steering them in certain directions because they knew those were the good directions to go in, where the children would learn the most. And yet the children felt affecting their own learning. And the teachers concerned initially thought, I could never do that. But they gradually built up those skills. And those are the skills, I think, that are embedded within a curriculum for excellence. But they're not going to happen through little individual lessons on thinking skills or whatever. They need time and, you know, a model, something like the Leonardo effect or the Leonardo effect, to give them time to do that and to develop it, and for the children to get used to learning in that way as well.
No, I think we'd need to definitely agree that time is probably our most precious resource, and probably throwing it away in some way or throwing it at a subject is the best idea, is not to get too, although it's the most precious thing, getting too uptight about it and too fixed about it is going to spoil things. Having said that, our time is getting kind of short here. I just like to just make sure that it's the leonardoeffect.com is your website, where you've got a ton of information about the Leonardo effect, and you are on Twitter at @LeonardoEffect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you've also, as we briefly mentioned earlier, you've got a book coming out, which according to Amazon is coming out in December, am I right?
Yep, it's called The Leonardo Effect, Motivating Children to Achieve Through Interdisciplinary Learning.
Yeah.
It's interesting, we've written some of the chapters, but about 2/3 of them are written by principal teachers, head teachers, and teachers who've been working in the schools looking at different aspects of this. So it comes from a number of different sources, and I think from that point of view is very useful for teachers.
And two of them are Scottish. Fiona Loudon, principal or head teacher in Crookford Primary School, and Jem Anderson, who's with Education Scotland at the moment. She wrote one from the point of view of a newly qualified teacher, so they're really good chapters.
Yeah. Good stuff. That's great. It's good to hear Scotland, and I say it seems to be a real good fit with the Curriculum for Excellence. Almost a, just an example of the Curriculum for Excellence that I can see. So I just kind of thanks very much for having this chat. The audio here will be archived, and hopefully if you're listening, you might be listening at another time and place. Can I say thanks very much to Deirdre Robson and Ivor Hickey of the Leonardo Effect. We've been talking tonight about putting art into STEM and motivating pupils to achieve through interdisciplinary arts and science, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it was a fantastic and fascinating evening. So thanks very much, folks.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Right, and I'm just hanging up now.